Absolutely. I think when I was younger, I really had to have something that excited me and that I felt was gonna be kind of like the hook of the piece before I even started anything. And I think, my ability to write a lot more now has come from the fact that I don't feel that pressure. I'm much more patient that maybe it'll emerge later. And if it doesn't, composing for me is just bliss land. I completely lose track of time. So if nothing comes from it, I got to live in that world for a little bit, and that's okay too.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. Sam Sadagurski has released 13 acclaimed albums as a leader and has appeared on over 60 albums as a side musician, including several Grammy-winning projects. He's a member of the Philip Glass Ensemble and has toured and recorded with artists like Brad Meldow, Darcy James Argue's Secret Society, and Gabriel Kahane. Sam also served as the onstage clarinetist for the Grammy, Tony, and Emmy-winning Broadway show The Band's Visit, and has performed in over 20 other Broadway productions. In addition to his performance work, Sam has published 5 volumes of original clarinet etudes and duets. In this episode, we focus on his Solomon Diaries project with Nathan Cosey, featuring excerpts and full tracks. Details are linked in the show notes with timestamps. Sam also reflects on his early career in jazz, shaped by mentors like Brad Meldow, Bill Berry, and Lee Konitz. As this episode is released, he's touring Europe with the Philip Glass Ensemble, performing, among other pieces, the iconic Koyaanisqatsi. We also dive into his thoughts on how improvisation training extends beyond music into life, the issues with streaming algorithms, and the culture history of the Borscht Belt. From biking to Tower Records as a kid in LA to his diverse compositional influences, Sam discusses how his musical evolution remains deeply personal. We begin by learning about his musical immigrant family and the roots of his journey. Hey, Sam, thanks so much for joining me here today.
Hey there. Thanks, Leah.
I'm just a bit overwhelmed with your output the last few years, but I understand a lot of it was pandemic related that you had more time.
Correct. Yeah. The first three Solomon Diaries were very much a pandemic. Well, a lot of them were composed before. But we kind of went nuts recording three albums because we could.
Yeah.
We had that time and that focus to do it. Nathan is so busy. Nathan Cosey is the accordionist, my duo partner, and is very much, it's now morphed into very much a collective project with the two of us. He's writing for it, and he's such a, it's built around the things he can do and his creative voice so much. But he's so busy now. It was an incredible gift in a way to kind of like have him almost all to myself during that period. And
Yeah.
so I ran with it.
Well, I hope to dig in quite a bit to the Solomon Diaries, especially volumes 4 and 5, but also later on get to some of your other projects because you do so much. You're so
Sure.
interesting. So let's get for people to get to know you a little bit. I was interested in that your parents had immigrated from the USSR in the 70s. I mean, there weren't a lot of people able to get out at that time.
Yeah, they were kind of the first part of the first wave of Jews who were allowed out under an agreement that Nixon made
Yeah.
with the Soviets. That was basically trading Jewish immigrants for food assistance. So yeah, I mean, I think my parents and their extended family always had this intention to leave by any means they could, and they got it. And yeah, my sister, I have an older sister who was actually born there, who came with them, and my brother and I were born in the US.
Yeah. So growing up in California and in terms of integrating with some kind of Jewish community, what was that like for you as a son of immigrants?
I was raised pretty secular, I'd say. I mean, I think there was always like a cultural amount of Judaism, and my brother and I both had bar mitzvahs. And we lived in a place with a pretty substantial Jewish community. So I didn't feel like an outsider, really. But yeah, I don't think it was something that was very, deep in my consciousness necessarily growing up. I think as I grew older, I started to just realize that this identity really just shaped the course of my family's life. I mean, my parents' whole, you know, ability to not only all the things that happened in Europe and the Soviet Union before they left, but also their ability to leave was basically because they were Jewish.
Did they talk to you or your grandparents about what it was like? You know, because I came from the generation, part of my family left in the 20s and some of them left earlier, but, you know, the same part of the world. Like, were there, had they tried to get out earlier?
I don't think there was just any avenue for getting out. I do have, you know, my father had an uncle who actually immigrated to Palestine, you know, before it became Israel and fought in the War of Independence there. But as far as I know, he's actually the only one who kind of like got out before mm-hmm. that period. And then, yeah, my parents had some musician friends who, you know, defected in various ways. They were musicians, and there's actually a great joke. How do you form a Soviet duo? And the punchline is you put a quartet out on tour. But yeah, I mean, in terms of like Russia, I think it was much more an awareness of kind of, you know, this immigrant and Russian culture. I mean, my parents continued to really be close with a lot of people who they had grown up with and they had gone to music conservatory with. And I think if anything, I grew up in two worlds, you know, in terms of that, like wanting yeah. to assimilate and be an American kid. And also, you know, on weekends, be dragged to the Russian restaurant to, you know, a party that would go on till 2 a.m.
And would your dad play music at some of these parties?
Yeah, I mean, not just my dad. I mean, their whole kind of circle of friends were musicians. Some of them sort of were able to actually carve out livings as musicians. And some of them kind of, you know, had to go into other professions. Actually, you know, my father, as far as his vocation, became a piano technician around the time I was born, or maybe a little bit before that even. But they would always kind of become somewhat drunken jam sessions as the night went on. And I have very, very fond memories of those moments. They were mostly classically trained musicians, but there was this sort of like folk element with them. And yeah, it was, you wouldn't hear them at those parties. They wouldn't be playing sonatas. They'd be playing kind of like Russian and Jewish folk songs. And, you know, there'd be a lot of vodka flowing.
I was just curious, because your dad played accordion and clarinet.
Correct.
And you really leaned into jazz growing up and saxophone.
I did. Yeah. It was my father really, really loved jazz. It was not something he could really, really play, but he did have a love for it, and you know, was really amazing. And coming back from working, you know, an 11-hour day tuning pianos, and then would take me into the city in LA to go hear a lot of my heroes. And those were very.
That's great.
Yeah.
Do you have any musical memories from that time, like a show you heard?
I consider myself so lucky to have grown up in LA, which was, you know, a major hub for, you know, not only musicians who live there, but musicians coming through, and hearing Joe Lovano early on and Joe Henderson, were Lee Konitz a lot of times, Charles Lloyd, those were really huge for me. And the second I got my driver's license when I was 16, I was in the city, you know, at least two or three nights a week, going to see whatever I could.
Okay. And your mom's a pianist and piano teacher.
Correct.
I'm imagining a lot of the composition you do is on piano.
Yes, I've actually tried to move away from that a little bit more over the years, because I have some training on piano. It was my first instrument, but I don't have the independence of hands that I would really like to have. And, you know, and so I find myself kind of limited by that. And also, yeah, sometimes my writing at the piano can lack a certain imagination, I think, that I have when I'm playing the clarinet. Mm-hmm. I would say now it tends to be a mix. I'll kind of like record a lot of voice memos of things that come up into my phone, and then later on I might, move to the piano to realize them.
Okay. Well, let's get into the albums a little bit. Yeah, track 9, VNP Hora, is dedicated to your dad, Isaac.
Yes.
What is VNP?
Okay, so a young piano technician at my father's, there was a gathering after his funeral, gave a speech. My father, when he was sick, was actually sending a lot of his clientele to this young tuner and a few others. He was talking about these little abbreviations in my dad's kind of client records that he would find. My dad was really, really great about keeping notes about, where the dog's name and where their kids were going to college and what they were majoring in. And he would look at this right before going to a client's house. The clients would be really, really amazed that he could remember this. And of course, he had a cheat sheet. But anyways, he had a lot of VIP clients, and he would always kind of put that in there. But VNP was a very nice person.
Oh.
Some people got the VNP, and then eventually, when there were enough VNPs, some people got the VVNP. Yes, my father was an incredible VNP himself, and so it was a dedication to that. That piece I actually wrote, sort of in the Jewish tradition, the gravestone is not unveiled until, the 1 year after the person's passing. And and there's typically, a ceremony of the closest family that goes. And I was going to travel to Los Angeles to be there for that with everybody, and then unfortunately my son came down with strep that morning and I had to cancel the trip. And I wrote that song that morning.
Oh. Yeah, I'm sorry to hear you couldn't be there for the unveiling. That's hard.
Thank you.
Yeah, and being so far from family, you moved out to New Jersey for college. What was that like? I mean, your access to New York must have been so exciting, but the change from West Coast to East Coast.
In a weird way, like moving to New York was something I knew I was going to do from probably the time I was 15 years old or something, when it, was really just clear that I had no choice but to follow this path with music. And my heroes lived in New York, and kind of like my heart was already here, in a way, even before I had like physically moved here. I don't think the weight of that really bears on an 18-year-old's mind, and what that actually means, in terms of, practicality and what it's like emotionally to be so far away from your family and the community you grew up with. But I was really lucky to, immediately find a community here, and I went to William Patterson, which is, 20, 25 minutes from the George Washington Bridge, and almost every night of the week, there was a caravan of students going into the city. Sometimes we didn't even, have a specific show we were going to go see. We would just at that point in time, this was like the late 1990s. I mean, you just went and parked in the West Village and you walked around to see what was going on, or you might have picked up a Village Voice and found the listings there. But there were so many clubs in a concentrated area at that time, and that's something that, I really. Makes me very, very sad when I think about that no longer existing. I mean, there's just kind of like a few left in that area. Now, there's a lot of music venues, but they're spread out. There's a lot of them are in Brooklyn, and they become like a special destination in themselves.
Yeah, I remember I haven't been to New York that often, but I was there in the late 80s and early 90s, and I remember that, being able to walk around all these jazz clubs. Just randomly, I saw this movie called Patterson, set in Patterson, New Jersey. Have you seen it?
Yeah, I have. I like that movie a lot with Adam Driver, right?
Yeah, Jim Jarmusch. Yeah, I just thought I'd mention it because it was a beautiful movie that Pat Irwin, I don't know if you've run across him, he'd recommended it. He's on this podcast a couple times.
Okay.
Well, let's get back to the fifth album, volume five, 6 Miles at Midnight, which I love. First of all, it features Meg Okura, who's been on this podcast, so I want
Oh,
to
love
mention
it.
that.
Okay.
Yeah. And I hear a trumpet, but there's no trumpet credit.
Thought we did put it in. That's Nathan Cosi, actually.
Okay.
Amazingly, Nathan Cosi was a classical French horn
Yeah.
player in college, and actually, it's what he moved to New York, kind of intending to really pursue. And accordion was kind of a side instrument that he picked up as a teenager. Besides French horn, he also plays various trumpets. Yeah, his trumpets really came to the rescue, on that track.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Maybe I missed it because his name was already listed and I didn't see the extra instrument listed. So maybe you had it there.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, it gives a, like almost like a, I don't know, Tijuana brass kind of energy. There's something really, really deliciously kind of kitschy about it.
Oh, it's really beautiful.
good. I kind of love that. That was a track that we recorded later in the day. I mean, I'm a little nuts. Not only do I put out a lot of records, but we record them in, sometimes just a few days. I mean, these volumes 4 and 5 were 2 days of tracking in a studio, and it's a lot of music to track in 2 days. So, I think it's like some of the tracks end up kind of like being compromised in some way. Just either you're rushing through them or doing them at the end of the day. And that was one that we did do at the very, very end of the day. And I think we were just a little cooked, as my kids would say, by that point. And it felt a little bit kind of lethargic and draggy. And I think those trumpets, just like that we added later, gave it an amazing lift.
Yeah, I would have said dreamy, but so the title, 6 Miles at Midnight, is that coming from your experience of recording late?
No, that's actually a reference to Erik Satie. I mean, that
Okay.
piece really, to me, had this had his influence written all over it. He would apparently have this, I don't know if it was 3 miles each way or 6 miles each way, but he played at this, he was a cafe pianist for his entire life. And the place was actually quite far away from him. And so he had this walk that he would do coming home every night from there.
Okay.
So since the title came from that. loved Satie, and I think, yeah, I mean, my sort of biggest professional association now and a huge influence on me has been, you know, being part of the Philip Glass Ensemble, and this world of minimalism has really, you know, changed the way I think and the way I listen to music. And yeah, really, Satie was one of the first minimalists for me.
So coming from this kind of denser jazz background in terms of, you know, harmony and rhythm and playing with the Philip Glass Ensemble, what has changed for you?
Yeah, I think the jazz mentality is always, you know, I think I was always taught, like, you want to add new material, you know. Let's add this scale language. Let's add this sort of riff or whatever. And yeah, I think that world that Glass resides in is just like, how much can I do with this really bare amount of material? And yeah, I like that. You know, I listened to an interview with Shai Maestro, the incredible jazz pianist, and just, you know, he's one of the most amazing voices in creative music for me. And he talked about so much modern jazz feeling like, you know, taking somebody to an amazing exhibition in a museum, but like shuttling them through on a moped, you know, and just like how quickly so much jazz just like moves through material. And I think I've really like come to appreciate just trying to slow that down. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of the things I really love now, I would have dismissed as easy listening, you know, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think these are just the shifts that people make in their listening and their own creative pursuits. And yeah, I think there's something really nice about reaching middle age and being okay with these directions.
You know, the film Koya Niskatsi, featuring music of Philip Glass, I saw it in the theater when it had first come out, and I was a teenager in 1982. Uh-huh. Made this, in fact, I think it's the one and only time I've ever seen a film by myself, just randomly. And it just made this huge impression on me.
Yeah, it's amazing that you even remember that detail. And yeah, that's kind of, that is like our workhorse piece that we travel the world doing. And it's amazing how many people come up to us and have those clear memories of seeing it for the first time. And kind of how, I don't know if earth shattering is the word, but it really, it's a powerful piece that I think even people coming to see it for the first time when we do it, it still speaks to them all these 40 years later.
You're doing it with the film is what I was curious about.
With the film. Sometimes, okay. Sometimes with orchestra, there's a full orchestration, and sometimes just as an ensemble. Mm-hmm.
So for those people who haven't seen it, can you just speak to it a little bit?
Yeah, it's a collaboration between Godfrey Reggio, the filmmaker, and Philip Glass. And it actually sort of reversed. I think there was a basic concept for the film, and it's all just footage that Godfrey Reggio has you know, gone around the world shooting. Some of it's of nature, some of it's of society. But he really, Godfrey sort of assembled the film based on the music that Philip had written. It kind of reversed the typical process, which is somebody writing to a film that's already made. So there's really, there's a depth there. The film speaks to sort of, Koya Niskatsi means out of balance. So human beings and civilization being out of balance with nature.
Yeah, I'm sure people can stream it nowadays, but if they can see it live with your ensemble, I saw your touring schedule, they should check it out.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was kind of, it's considered the first real kind of minimalist film score, mm-hmm. as well. So I think it has a lot of weight as that as well.
Yeah. So some of your music, even on like Migrations on Volume 5, definitely hear that influence.
It's hard to, you can't run away from it. It's so powerful. But I kind of I hope bits of me are slipping in there.
Of course, yeah.
Yes. I mean, yeah, I'm very conscious. I mean, Philip Glass has been so maybe imitated more than any other living composer, I think. And especially, if you watch film and television score, I think his language is just so powerful and effective, that lots of other people are using it. And so, yeah, I have some self-consciousness about doing it, but I think now, like, I don't put so much pressure on myself as a composer in terms of like starting off with material that I think is particularly original or brilliant or fetching. I'm kind of, I love the process now where I'll kind of, if I have the time, launch into it with something that is, kind of stupid or banal or cliche or whatever. And I think there's now a trust that something of me will emerge and something that is good will emerge.
Yeah. I've been improvising just for a few years, coming from a classical background. But what I found very freeing about it is just this, that you can create something out of anything.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when I was younger, I really had to have something that excited me and that I felt was gonna be kind of like the hook of the piece before I even started anything. And I think, my ability to write a lot more now has come from the fact that I don't feel that pressure. I'm much more patient that maybe it'll emerge later. And if it doesn't, composing for me is just bliss land. I completely lose track of time. And so if nothing comes from it, I got to live in that world for a little bit, and that's okay too.
That's one of the best quotes ever. Well, for those clarinetists and clarinet teachers listening, I do want to point them towards your book of etudes and solo pieces and duos. These duos, you recorded both parts. Was that hard to do?
For some of them, I was very, very lucky to work with Joe Brent, who is the founder and the real driving force of Adiaropa Records and a really phenomenal engineer and musical mind himself. And he does a lot of tracking of his own records on his own. And I think, having his musicianship and creativity, I'm very, very indebted to him for sort of like making all that work.
Thank you. I assume you teach?
I do. Yeah.
I was curious if your approach to teaching is different than what you were exposed to and how your creativity, like how you encourage your students to be creative.
The teaching I'm doing is much more beginner and intermediate. Mm-hmm. Sort of I made this choice. I never got a master's degree, so a lot of the sort of like higher ed teaching was closed off by that. You know, I live in the suburbs of New York. I'm in Westchester County, a little bit north of the city. And so there's not a huge amount of musicians living up here in competition. So instead of sort of pursuing maybe higher level students somewhere, I've sort of chosen to stay at home and teach, you know, more beginner oriented students. I teach piano as well. I feel like my early teaching, the teaching that I got early on from my teacher, Vince Trombetta, has really shaped me creatively and how I approach things and just, you know, learning by doing things and not learning out of books or feeling this need to like really study something before just kind of doing it. Mm-hmm. The way I learned to improvise, for example, was just by he would have me compose solos, you know, and this was before I really had built any semblance of an actual like jazz improvisation language at all. I mean, I would just, you know, really only knowing how to play these chords in root position, would sit at the piano and just find lines and little melodies that sounded good to me. Yeah, there was just kind of a learning by doing that that I think I still am shaped by.
So that was back in LA?
That was in LA, yeah.
Okay.
I was very lucky. I grew up kind of in the suburbs of LA, and Vince was somebody who lived in the next town over. It would be really, really fun to work with somebody, you know, a 20-year-old with a lot of drive and talent, and once in a while, I do get to do that. The world of higher education and academia is just not for me, and, you know, I even felt that going to college. College for me was more of a way. There were a few teachers I did meet who did have a lot of influence on me. But in terms of like things that happened in the classroom, there was very, very little, you know, effect. And I think it was more just a way of getting to New York and building a community. And there are a few people I went to school with who I still see and play with now and then. That's an incredible connection to still have.
You know, a lot of people I've spoken to on this series, even if they went to the fanciest, most expensive school, it's really the collaborations, the people they met, that was often the thing that impacted them the most long term.
Definitely.
Hi, just a really short break from the episode. I've linked several episodes you'll love in the show notes, with Meg Okura, Tasha Warren, Yael Strom, Colleen Allen, John Hadfield, and Rachel Eckroth. In the show notes, you'll also find a link to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get exclusive information about upcoming guests, a link for my Ko-fi page to support this project directly, and my podcast merchandise store with a design commission from artist Steffi Kelly. You can also review this podcast, share it with your friends, and follow on your podcast app, YouTube, and social media. All this helps spread the word. Thanks. Now, back to my conversation with Sam.
Back to the Solomon Diaries. Lucky for Sarah with Danny Fox on piano.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Lucky. It's actually one of the only songs that we do in kind of a traditional jazz format in which, you know, it's an 18-bar song, which is what the title comes from. You know, 18 is the number high in Judaism and is a lucky number. And Sarah's my wife, and I met her on August 18th. We were married September 18th. Oh. So, you know, it has a lot of resonance for us. And she's wanted a song she's like been wondering where's my song for a long time. So she got her song. And yeah, it's an 18-bar song, and it's the only one we do kind of in that traditional jazz format where we play the head and we solo and then we play the head again. It's kind of like a, you know, jam kind of song. Danny Fox is a pianist and composer, and we actually go back to our teenage years meeting in the national Grammy band when we were, I don't know, 16 and 15 or 17 and 16,
yeah,
or whatever. So, yeah, and I've kept up with Danny, and it's one of, you know, the most special and prized relationships for me. And yeah, I think all the guests we brought on for volumes 4 and 5 not only kind of musically had very special places in our life, but also I think personally as well.
You know, I wanted to ask you about some of these teenage experiences you had. You got to tour Japan, you played with Brad Meldow, you had like all these early experiences. Do you want to, like, was there a particular mentor or experience that really stayed with you or affected you from that time?
I think most of all it was the music that I saw. Mm-hmm. I did, yeah, that concert with Brad Meldow was an incredible thing. I mean, he's somebody, he moved to LA for a little bit and really didn't know anybody there. And we were introduced, and I was, I don't know, a bit of a precocious and punkish little, 18-year-old who had a lot of opinions, and I think he got a kick out of that. Yeah, we got to play a little bit, and he asked me to do this duo gig with him. And then later on, once I'd moved to New York, invited me to be part of something at Zenkel Hall with him. That's been, both those experiences have been very, very prized for me. And then, I went to Japan with the Monterey Jazz Festival High School All-Stars, which I think is a program that's actually still going. Hopefully they still go to Japan. But that was an amazing experience. That was with a cornet player named Bill Berry, kind of directed that ensemble. And Bill had toured with Duke Ellington in Duke's kind of later period in the 70s, I believe. Bill actually became kind of a mentor for me, and I would go to a lot of his gigs in LA, and he would have me sit in, and those are very prized experiences. And then, my first actual recording session, real professional recording session in a studio on an album that came out, was something that Bill invited me for. It was a record with the Japanese clarinetist Eiji Kitamura. And the rhythm section was Ray Brown and Jake Hanna. So Ray Brown being, perhaps the most recorded jazz bassist alive, and one of the most influential. I was a lucky little kid.
Well, I'm curious, now that you're a dad, how are you managing arts education for your kids?
I am doing my best. With kids, you have to meet them where they are. And my kids are growing up in such a different world from the world that I grew up in. And, I think more than anything, you do your best to model certain behaviors. And I think as kids grow up, they remember those things, and maybe they are shaped by them, and maybe they're not. I mean, I think some kids are more pliable than others as well. And I think some of the best, advice that I've gotten as a parent, or that I can give, is, number one, you choose your battles, and also to meet your kids where they are. Just in terms of the way music is consumed, it's so incredibly different now. Mm. And my kids stream all their music, and with that comes, a lack of patience and a certain passivity to just let the algorithm dictate what they listen to. And it's really, really frightening. And it's really frightening to, see that happen in my own house, under my very own eyes.
Yeah.
So I hope it's something that can somehow be reckoned with or addressed in some way. I feel like not just for me, but for, my generation growing up, I mean, the things we listened to were really, for a lot of us, very, very personal and defined who we were as people. And I'm afraid that it's just becoming a big monolith. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, there's something to be said for growing up with those few albums or few mixtapes or,
Absolutely. Yeah, there was a certain choice you were making and a commitment to the music you were consuming. I mean, I started teaching music lessons when I was 14 years old. Every cent I made just went to, riding my bike over to Tower Records, which was nearby, and building a music collection.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to keep those albums, or what happened to them?
I have the CDs, but I kind of lost the room to display them, and now they're in boxes in the attic, which is a sad thing, but maybe someday, some sort of home setup will emerge again, where I can actually have them out and start consuming music in a much more wholesome way again.
So you, for many years, you played on Broadway, and like you had this, the band's visit really influenced, and you had like an onstage role.
Yes. Yeah, that kind of like happened a little bit by accident. And I got attached to the show where it's based on an Israeli movie of the same name. And it's about kind of a band of Egyptian musicians traveling to Israel to perform a concert. And they kind of get on the wrong bus and end up stranded in this kind of like nowhere town in the middle of the desert. And it's a very, very human story that I think transcends politics, about just humans interacting and seeing each other's lives up close. And yeah, oddly enough, I was actually, you know, one of these Egyptian musicians. I mean, and the musicians were on stage, and most of us didn't have any lines, but we were real characters in it. And there was a lot of kind of like quasi acting to learn. And we became very, very close with the actors who were in it. And, you know, I'm really happy that I've carried a lot of those relationships with me since the show closed in 2019. But yeah, it being part of that show gave me a real love for theater and appreciation for it that I hadn't had before. Even though I had been playing on Broadway for 15 years before that, it's typical that, you know, the orchestras in a show are just brought in basically like a day or two before tech begins, or actually no, just at tech. And they're not really part of the process of actually building a show. And since we were on stage in the band's visit, we were part of 6 weeks of like full-time cast rehearsals before we went into the theater at all. And I really just saw the show built by the incredible team that was behind it. I mean, David Cromer was the director, and he's really one of the genius directors of our time. Noted, you know, MacArthur genius. Yeah, seeing the actors work and the commitment they brought was had a really, really profound effect on me. And then on top of that, it was an incredible experience because this was a situation where the musicians were not only on stage, but a lot of the music we played was sort of featured like a concert and was improvised. And so, yeah, and it really, like, the music had a lot of, you know, Arabic and Israeli influence in it. And, you know, I'm not trained in any way in either of those, but I can fake it. And that's going to be, like, on my tombstone, but he could fake it. But anyways, yeah, I learned from the people around me and got really, you know, deeper and deeper into it. I mean, I think, you know, there were some real talents in that show who I think had a lot more schooling that I really, really got a lot from.
Yeah. I mean, you could call faking it having great musical instincts and, you know, skill.
Yeah.
It's a different way of putting it.
Yeah. I mean, no matter how much training you have in anything, so much in life is faking it and making it up as you go. And, you know, I think actually the training that we do get as improvisers actually is such great training for life, you know, and back to teaching, you know, so few people will actually, you know, go into music and make a career out of it. But I think the lessons they might get from that are so incredibly valuable, and no matter what they do.
And Sam, I believe you're writing a musical now as well.
I was. It's something that I kind of have walked away from a little bit, okay. But this was another, you know, kind of wild, unexpected pandemic project that lands into my lap. It was about Joseph Pulitzer, who I hadn't really known anything about before being approached to be part of this. But there was basically, you know, a full sort of book for this musical, and they were looking for a composer. And I did it, and I wrote, 12 or 13 songs that I'm very, very proud of. Yeah, musicals take many, many years to see through, and it's a tough mountain to climb. And I think just at some point, I wanted to put my energy into things that I could kind of see through and put out.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I still have those songs, and one day if the chance arises, I would love to actually sort of produce some of them and release some of them, because I'm very proud of them.
You have an album of solo piano music that's very interesting from 2022, Figures, Broken Pieces, inspired by lives that were lost in 2020, but not necessarily COVID, like different causes of death.
There was a period of about 4 months in the beginning of the pandemic when I kind of just stopped playing wind instruments altogether, to just sort of, help my family out and help my kids. They were here home from school basically all the time, and it was a very challenging time. But I did continue to play piano during that period. And I think the germs, a lot, the beginnings of a lot of these pieces kind of came around then. And then, yeah, I got a little bit of funding from somebody who's been a bit of a, patron of my music. And I don't know, it, I was very, very lucky in the pandemic, in that terms of my wife has a grown-up job, and our ability to pay our bills was never, really imperiled in the same way that it was for a lot of my colleagues and friends. So it felt a little bit weird to keep that money to myself, and this was a way of like dispersing it to some friends and having them record some of my music.
Yeah, they're short pieces. I thought it might be interesting, like you had mentioned Lee Konitz earlier, you have a very tiny little piece, Incidental Lee, dedicated to him.
Yeah, I got to know Lee a little bit. I saw him play so many times, and he is one of the, strongest influences on my musical world. And yeah, I did actually take a lesson with him when I was in school, which was an incredible experience. And yeah, I tend to write short pieces. Again, I think this is partly a reflection of a lack of training in terms of form. And knowing how to build out something in a more grand way, I guess. I don't know. I also just I like the idea of just kind of being in and out with something as well. So it works. All those pieces are actually in 3/4 on that record too. I don't know, something about that worked for me at the time as well.
So you grew up playing, piano and saxophone, and then I understand like you just played a lot of different instruments just to get all the gigs, but you've been focusing more on clarinet the last number of years.
Yes, piano was my first instrument. My mom was my first teacher, and that's kind of a difficult relationship to have. So eventually she started sending me to a friend of hers or a colleague of hers, and then my mom would teach that colleague's daughter. And that lasted a little while. Learning the piano is kind of a solitary pursuit for a long time. And I think once I got to junior high school and had this opportunity to be part of a very, very, strong school band program, I took up the saxophone, which was something my father had a saxophone in the house that he would play on weddings and such. Yeah, immediately there was a magic to me, not only in the instrument, but being able to do it in a group with peers, and that really excited me. And I kind of ran from there. But my two early teachers were both sticklers for, what saxophone players call doubling, which is also, developing, competence on the flute and clarinet, because it's very, very common for the three instruments to be in one part, and it makes you much more employable as a musician if you can play them. And I kind of started them really, really early, and I think was incredibly lucky in a lot of ways to do that, because they became part of my voice in a lot of ways. They made me very employable. Once I got to New York and was out of college. And then I think for a long time I was the guy who was called because I could do everything. And that kept me busy for a long time. And then I think I started to really get tired of what that meant for me. And to I started paring it down. And the clarinet, I think, also just started to feel like more and more of a voice, and there was more. It felt like there was more and more room in the clarinet world to explore. I think it just like started to feel more personal. I also started to play a lot more kind of Jewish music as part of my living. For the past almost 15 years now, a lot of my steady work is playing for synagogues in the New York area. Very, very grateful for that work, and it's really shaped what I do.
So the Solomon Diaries, the first three volumes, you have these images of the Borscht Belt hotels, and I understand they're actually stock images, but they were influenced by
Marissa Sheinfeld, the photographer.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, there were complications in using Marissa's images on the covers. So we did find kind of some more historical stock images that we did use. But yes, finding Marissa's book, Marissa has a book called The Borscht Belt, actually. And what she did, she actually grew up in the Catskills amongst these places. And one of her teachers, as she was coming up, she was having trouble kind of like finding her creative path, and she was told, you know what, go photograph what you know. And she went home, and always had, she had grown up going to a lot of these places that were kind of now abandoned and falling into disrepair, and got to a lot of them just in time before they were kind of leveled completely, and has these, very incredible photos of the remnants of these once incredible resorts and bungalow colonies. It finding those photos launched me into this fascination with that story of the rise and fall of the Borscht Belt. I didn't grow up connected to any of these places whatsoever. I grew up completely on the West Coast and had almost no family on the East Coast who were connected to these places. And to me, I only knew about the Borscht Belt as kind of this kitschy reference to a certain brand of, comedy and entertainment. Hearing the story of just like how it rose and fell really resonated with me, I think particularly as a, first generation immigrant. And it was a story more than anything for me of immigrants in a new land, and the things that happen, the assimilation, the rejection, this sort of like real act of revolution that happened amongst Jews, after being kind of rejected from, vacationing with non-Jews. Sort of their response was to build their own destination.
Yeah, I've seen some of those of her photos, Marissa's photos online, and read a few articles actually in the last few years about like the incredible wealth, like, I forget the name. There was some director, and they're putting on, like, original musical theater performances, like, every week at this one of these places. It's just the amount of work that went into the creative work is quite inspiring.
Yes, absolutely. And, I mean, the list of entertainers that came through, or not just came through, but really got their starts there.
Yeah.
And yeah, Nathan and I have been really lucky to perform this music, and there's hardly a performance that we do in the New York area where somebody doesn't come with, you know, telling us that they grew up working in the region or playing music in the region or got married there. So yeah, it's a place that has an incredible resonance and meaning for a lot of Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think even had this influence on non-Jewish culture as well. And, you know, we do programs with Marissa now and then, and she has a slideshow where she shows both her own images and historical images. And I mean, one of the most powerful images is of Martin Luther King actually speaking at an event at one of the big hotels a week before he was assassinated.
Yeah. So did you meet Marissa as a result of the Solomon Diaries? Did you reach out to her?
I did, yeah. As soon as I kind of had this music and had even some rehearsal recordings, I did reach out. And she lives in Westchester County, actually about 20 or 30 minutes away from me. So we've been really lucky to get to know each other. And besides her photography, she's actually now doing some incredible work with what's called the Borscht Belt Historical Marker Project. Mm-hmm. Where they're going into these towns and the sites of these once incredible destinations that no longer exist, and actually putting historical markers of what was once there. And eventually, I think there's going to be 28 of them or so, and there's going to be a drive with an audio tour that they're creating that people will go be able to, you know, spend the day doing.
Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, I'd seen her website. I looked at that. I think it's funny. I was one of my daughters. She lives in Rotterdam. Speaking of moving away from home when you're 18, you know, I do read a plaque like when you pass. You know, it's always been my habit. Like, what happened here, kind of thing. And I remember her saying, like, "What, you actually read the plaques?" I'm like, "Yeah, I try to." But in Europe, like, really, you don't always know the reference. But sometimes it's really chilling to see, you know, what happened at that place or. Yeah.
Yeah. I love finding those plaques kind of accidentally sometimes. Yeah. I mean, while walking in the city and you see a plaque of Charlie Parker's, you know, house on Tompkins Square Park or Bartok's place on 57th Street. I mean, mm-hmm. both of those are ones that I kind of saw accidentally.
Mm-hmm. You know? On volume 4 of the Solomon Diaries, you have Secondhand, which is dedicated to Guy Klusevic.
Yeah.
So he was Nathan's mentor in some way?
I should say that's a composition of Nathan's. It's one of the two compositions. And yeah, he Nathan actually plays, his main accordion that he plays is one that he actually bought from Guy. So I think it's a reference to that accordion and a little pun of, you know, all the things Nathan is doing with both hands when he plays. But yeah, that's become one of the staples of our live performance. And I don't know, I kind of joke that, like, I'm a quantity guy with compositions and Nathan's a quality guy. Yeah, I mean, his compositions, we do two of them, Secondhand, and there's another called Home Theme on the two records. And they are two of the strongest.
Thank you.
Guy Klusevic. Yes, a mentor to a lot of accordionists and just incredible creative force. Somebody who's inspired me, not just as an accordionist, but, you know, with just like the level of output that he had. Yeah, there's something really special about people who just, for me, I don't know, put out a lot of music, and it becomes, and don't feel this pressure. They're, you know, like if you talk to classical people, you know, they'll talk about kind of two models of composers. You know, there's like the Haydn model and then, you know, the Brahms model or something. And, you know, there's a lot of validity with both. And I don't know, for me, I just love making music and making records so much that I haven't really curated my output so much. And, and I haven't put that pressure on myself for like everything that I put out has to feel like, you know, my best and the greatest thing. It's all just like where I was that day or that year or whatever. And yeah, early on, I mean, I'm sort of, you know, going a bit left here, but you know, yeah, early on, I think after I put on one of my first records, you know, there was a track that, you know, still to this day, I'm kind of embarrassed about, you know, that like, I just don't think it's very, very good. And, you know, from one of my friends, who's a very, very, somebody I have a huge amount of respect for as a musician and creatively, he loved that track. It was what spoke to him. And so, yeah, or even You Sang 6 Miles at Midnight, which is a track that, like, for a long time, Nathan and I went back and forth, like, about scrapping.
Yeah.
Because it had a lot of problems. So, anyways, yeah, I just decided that it wasn't going to be my place to curate this. And that's ended up being a little bit problematic for me. I think in today's world where, you know, somebody might go to my page on one of the streaming websites and just like pick the first thing or pick a random thing and they hear like something that's like a solo piano record or clarinet duets, yeah, they're missing out on something that I think could have represented me in a better way, or in a more whole way. But that's fine. I mean,
I'm a Bandcamp user, but for Spotify, I believe they curate, like you can't say feature this.
Yeah. No, it's problematic. I mean, yeah. So many, you know, non-musicians who aren't like, I don't know, fluent in the way of like navigating the streaming platforms. I mean, if you look me up on there, the first thing that come up are the things I've done with Darcy James Argue. Yeah. Who, you know, probably gets more plays than virtually any other stuff where I'm listed as an artist. And so, yeah, so many of, you know, my kids' friends will say, oh, yeah, we checked you out on Spotify. We listened to, and then they tell me the track. And it was Darcy James Hargy's track. So, anyways, that's one of the, you know, pratfalls or downfalls of the streaming world and the way these platforms are designed.
Yeah. My podcast is available, you know, on all these different platforms. And I, originally I was hosted by a smaller company that got bought out by Spotify. So they were actually my host. And then I was disgusted because they started removing episodes because even like people would be improvising on the podcast and they say, we don't recognize this music as licensed or it's not recognized. So we're just removing the whole episode. You know, so I never liked them, but this kind of thing. Yeah. So I encourage people to not listen to this podcast on Spotify because there'll probably be things missing anyway. Go to another.
Well, it's on the other streaming platforms.
All the other streaming platforms and YouTube. Okay. And yes.
Yeah. Because I've started listening, you know, I deleted Spotify a while ago. You know, to me, they're kind of the most appalling and disgusting and also the biggest force in the music world right now. So, you know, I moved over to Tidal, which is to me has less of the toxic elements. I mean, there's still no actual meaningful remuneration to the musicians who are making the music. But Tidal actually doesn't have podcasts, so I've had to kind of listen to my podcasts elsewhere.
It's interesting how many platforms there are, and there's these dedicated podcast apps that have special features that, like Overcast. I actually just use Apple Podcasts usually for myself, but yeah, there's if you look on my website and I link all the platforms, I don't know, there's like 20. Like, it's crazy. It's just all these different platforms people
Yeah.
use. Yeah. Well, speaking of generative and creativity, you have these other albums with poetry. And in fact, your one from 2008, The Words Project, Steve Smith named the vocal album of the year.
Yes, that was my first record, as a leader. I think I was in my late 20s. And I don't know, I think I had actually, compared to today's standards of, 19-year-olds making records, like waited a long time and really wanted to feel like I had something to give and something to say. And yeah, I think I've just never liked this world of music for musicians. And I mean, I think that's part of my problem with academia and that world as well, is it's sort of like, we're just going to speak to ourselves. And yeah, I sort of discovered this world of using text and poetry. I was not the first to do it at all, but yeah, to me, like, it was a way of maybe reaching people who were not, the Illuminati in the jazz world. And I loved collaborating with singers and what that meant. I mean, I actually don't play very much on those records, and that didn't really matter to me. And yeah, I was very, very lucky with that first record. I mean, there was still, when it came out, I mean, first of all, it was before streaming, and I think still, making a record had a certain weight to it. And I was really lucky to team up with the people at New Amsterdam Records very early on, who've since, I was one of the first people that they put out, but have since really become a force in this kind of genreless, like, indie classical, indie rock world. And so yeah, I got a lot of support from them. And yeah, there was still sort of like a ecosystem of music critics and music journalism, that really gave that record a huge lift. And actually, I still, the record's actually coming up on 20 years old, and I actually determined to kind of mark it in some way, or maybe try to perform it live. But that I went on to make kind of four more albums that use text and poetry. And I still think that first one is actually the best and the strongest, and amongst the best of, anything I've made. A lot of making albums and making art is, I mean, you put in the work, but there's just a lot of luck too. And I'm not talking about luck in terms of it catching and finding an audience, but luck in terms of like it being documented in the best possible way. I mean, just, really assembling the right team and finding those people at a really, when they're all in a good place and healthy and everything, and everybody getting along, that record was a really, really special experience, where I just feel everybody on it was all in. And and I had I it was my first record. I didn't know a lot of the things that I knew now, that I know now about making records, but I had just an incredible team of people. And insanely enough, that record was made on one frenetic, like, 6-hour rehearsal of just the, I think it has four singers on it. I mean, each singer is just coming for an hour and a half to do their things. And that's, I mean, I will say that I'd gotten together with people individually. Everybody on the record, I think I had done individual rehearsals, but there was one, just one rehearsal with everybody. And somehow it just, it worked.
Yeah.
And I'm very, very proud of that record. And also, like, there are a lot of, there's some singers on there who've gone on to do some, you know, incredible work as solo artists. And it's cool that I got them early on, you know, people like Becca Stevens and Heather Massey, in particular.
So do you have any upcoming new projects with Nathan or other?
Yes, I do. I just recorded a duo record with an Israeli pianist named Yotam Ishai that will hopefully come out later this year. I'm trying to do like one thing a year. I've really like set that, you know, goal. Yeah, it gives my life meaning to have a creative thing that I'm working on. And so yeah, this thing with Yotam, it's some of my compositions and some of his, and then a lot of his arrangements of some Israeli kind of folk songs as well. And it's a project that, you know, has a lot of meaning for me personally. You know, in the same way that the Solomon Diaries did, and you know, even the Words Project, the settings of text and poetry. I mean, a lot of the poetry that I chose to set, you know, not only resonated with me as poetry, but you know, like I set a lot of, there were a number of like Soviet poets who I set in that series as well. So, yeah, Nathan and I are continuing to perform. I mean, one of the goals with the Solomon Diaries was that it's just a duo and we can kind of perform anywhere. We don't need a lot of infrastructure. We basically just need like two armless chairs and we will come play for you. So we've done a lot of like house concerts and concerts in sanctuaries and places that, you know, might not always host music. I'm really, really, it's been incredibly freeing to have that. I mean, one of the things with the Words Project, working with the singers and with piano and guitar and drums, it was just very, very difficult to put together a gig, to assemble the people and to find the right venue and whatever. And it's very, very freeing to now kind of be more in this kind of world of duos.
Yeah.
Where there's just one other mouth to feed.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for this today. I really appreciated it.
Thank you, Leah. It was a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. I'm an independent podcaster and I really do need the help of my listeners. All the links are in the show notes. The podcast theme music was written by Nick Cold. Have a wonderful week.